Good afternoon and welcome to Who's in the Kitchen. You're listening to WDRT Community Radio 91.9 FM. And it's also streaming live on the internet at WDRT.org. You can also go to that website and look up previous shows. Just look up the archives and look for locally produced shows, and you'll find Who's in the Kitchen. And we have a lot of podcasts now that are available from previous shows. We used to only just have one for a week. But thanks to the work of our staff here at WDR Community Radio, we have a lot of podcasts now. So if you've heard a show, you want to hear a show again, sometimes I suggest, you know, taking out a pad of paper and taking notes, because some of my guests have just so much information that you really want to have it written down, or you can listen again later on. And so I want to welcome my guest today, Sherry Nolden. Welcome, Sherry.
Thank you.
Sherry spelled with C-H-E-R-R-I-E. Is that right?
Yes. Yep.
But it's pronounced Sherry.
Yep.
And I know Sherry just in many different ways. We have mutual friends, and she lives near Dodgeville. And she and her husband run a farm, and they raise quite a few animals, which she can tell you about. And Sherry is very educated and has a really strong background in agriculture, especially with animal husbandry. And I'll let you her explain to you what her studies have involved and what her specialty is. But today, we are probably really going to talk about stuff that you harvest, how you preserve it. Here we are in, you know, the beginning of August, and, you know, everybody's rushing around trying to save everything for the winter, because when you live in Wisconsin, there's about 6 months where you can't run out to the garden. And if you care about food that's seasonal and local, there's going to be a lot of things that you're going to want to preserve in some way, and so that we can get through the winter. It's different from if you just think of going to the store and just buying something that's totally out of season, but you can get it because it comes from Chicago, from California or Mexico or something like that, Florida. When you live in the northern states, you got to really preserve this wonderful harvest that we're getting right now. So, without further ado, I'm going to talk with Sherry. And Sherry, you have been really, it seems to me you've been a student ever since I've known you, for about the last 3 or 4 years. So what are you studying? And you have some degrees already, and you're going on.
Yeah, I will probably forever be a student, a lifelong student, just because I love learning. And I have formal degrees in wildlife ecology and agroecology from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I've been working on a PhD in animal and dairy sciences. And it's the combination or the intersection of a lot of what I learned in even like 4-H nature space program when I was a kid, studying botany in the wildlife ecology program, and having raised animals on the farm or on a hobby farm when I was a kid, and then expanding that to producing our own animals on our own farm starting in 2001, and then interspersing all of the just maintaining the farm and raising animals in as healthy of a way as I can, and for both the animals and for the food products that they produce for us. Watching what they eat, understanding wildlife ecology and what wildlife find to eat and how they survive out there. And then just appreciating all of both the native things in our environment and the introduced things that some people look at as typical garden weeds, which instead of pulling them out to favor the horticultural lettuce varieties, we could just turn them into salads ourselves. And all those weeds are tend to be more nutrient dense, higher protein, more flavorful, and just excellent at outcompeting everything else around them. So right. You don't need any tending. If anything, they need thinning. And by thinning, you are
harvesting,
making salad for dinner, and there's no purchased greens that are going bad in the fridge, because you can just go out and harvest them any time of year that's during the growing season here for eating. And then if you wanted, you can freeze them, harvest enough and freeze to use them for wilted types of greens during the winter, or can them. I know a lot of, in the Depression era, people would harvest and can lamb's quarters or mallow, some of the other more durable plants that held up to the canning process, and then mix that with some bacon grease or other oils and
get their
salt,
greens,
pepper, and
and
essentially have wilted cooked greens in the middle of winter, full of all of the nutrient values that those plants provide. So
yeah, well, I have a million questions. We could go in many, many directions on this, and that's just really, yeah, it's really fascinating. Yeah, I mean, in the now that we can freeze things, and we're finding out, you know, how different vegetables can be harvested to freeze, and fruits, a lot of us freeze instead of can, and there is kind of a controversy, I think, about, you know, how much food value is left in items that are canned. What's killed in the canning and what isn't. So we could talk about that too. I just love to talk about the wild foods and what's out there. But I see that, you know, having visited your farm, and you do have field days, and we can give some people information about that. It is really interesting how many wild forage foods there are for your domestically raised animals that are, you know, we've kind of moved away from that in agriculture, and, you know, just look like for certain things that are put in your pasture that you sow, instead of maybe relying on wild stuff. So I mean, there's so many directions we can go in, but let's just start with the salad that you made the other day. I was at your house and we had a wonderful salad, and I really don't eat raw lamb's quarters. That was really interesting. And some of the other ones that were in the salad, I knew you could eat them, but I never had. So let's just talk about that particular salad and then go on from there.
Yeah. So that salad is basically any young leaf of most of the weeds, the horticultural weeds that most people think of, that grow here randomly on their own without my intentional cultivation around the farmstead. And I'm actually in competition with our sheep over harvesting those for our own salads, because those are also the favorite foods of our sheep. And so often if we have like a weed salad next to lamb chops for dinner, we're eating the raw stuff, and then we're eating the stuff that ate the stuff that we're eating. And it's really amazing and tasty and wonderful for our bodies. And some of the plants that that are part of that, and most of them grow almost year-round, especially if they get mowed off or if they get set back in some way, there will be fresh new tips growing for most of those weeds throughout the growing season.
Oh, and so you can harvest them again from their second or third growth.
Yep, and and the way we manage our sheep, we use our sheep to mow our lawn. So we rotate them, we rotationally graze them around the 3 acres of lawn that goes around the buildings and the house and the garden and all the odd spots on the farm. We run the sheep through in a rotational system, and so they're constantly setting those plants back by just eating off the tops of them, and the plants regrow, and before the animals get back to them, then I go and harvest some of these for us to eat. And some of those plants include narrow and broadleaf plantain, purslane, which is really high in omega-3 fatty acids, and is really like crunchy and tasty, a little bit of sour flavor to it. Lamb's quarters, the tips of lamb's quarters, I just go along and pick those off, and they're full of iron and protein and other minerals. There's lots of different clovers. Typically white Dutch clover is what commonly grows everywhere around this part of Wisconsin, and these type of soils just volunteers. And so I harvest clover leaves and chickweed. There's lots of different varieties of chickweed. We don't plant it. It's just growing, and I go around and harvest from that. Smartweed is like, there's lots of species of that too. Lady's thumb might be the other name that people are familiar with, but the young leaves of that have a little bit of a sour flavor and add a really nice flavor to salads. There's mallow, which a lot of people probably recognize because it's kind of creeping, and they're always pulling it out of their garden, but it's also called cheese wheel plant, and mallow makes awesome salad greens because it has kind of a nutty flavor. So instead of needing to add like pine nuts or something to a salad, it adds kind of a soft and nutty flavor. Dandelion, young dandelion leaves, young violet leaves, young goldenrod leaves, wood sorrel, wild cucumber tendrils. That was one that some Hmong friends of ours introduced us to this time of year. That plant is growing all over as a big vine, kind of
yes.
light colored green leaves, not as rich, deep green as most of the surrounding vegetation. So it kind of sticks out. You can see it easily. And the tendrils of that are a delicacy to the Hmong culture. And you go around and pick those tendrils off. They're kind of sour and juicy and crunchy, and they just make a lot of pop and flavor in a salad or as a garnish for other things, and they're really pretty with the curly tendrils.
Wow, yeah.
So those are great. And young curly dock leaves, young garlic mustard leaves, young amaranth leaves,
pigweed.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So all these things that just want to grow around us make great salad greens. And if you have any question, most of those have been introduced to the United States as food plants brought over by the cultures that use them in Europe or other parts of the world because they were food plants for those people, and now there are horticultural weeds. But we can still use them as food plants if we understand that. And if you're wondering whether they're going to taste good in a salad, as you're going around your yard or the edge of the areas where you have access to and harvesting them, you just taste each leaf, each plant, and look for the parts of the plant that have the best flavor and harvest those from the plants in that area, collect them all up, wash them off, and then we make a salad dressing that I make from various things that I've either preserved or fixed around the farm here, grown like aronia berries. I like to make a aronia berry tincture or cordial. Cordial just has a little bit of maple syrup or honey or something added to it to make it a little sweeter. But a tincture is just soaking the crushed berries or ground up berries in alcohol, like a high proof alcohol, and using a Pearson's square to figure out the amount, the ratios of adding the volume of fruit to the amount of alcohol so that I at least get a 23% alcohol content so that can sit on the shelf and not need to sit in the cupboard or not need to sit in the refrigerator or be frozen or need to be canned. It's stable on the shelf as a liquid.
So this would be like 20. Vodka or Everclear?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Either one of those.
Yeah, because they don't have a flavor.
I'm using like 190 proof Everclear because it's 95% alcohol by volume and doesn't have any flavor. And I like to not have the alcohol flavor in the things that I'm preserving. And then the Pearson square, anybody can look that up for details on how to do that. But if you have two different items that have variable amounts of alcohol in them, or one component has no alcohol and the other component has high alcohol content, you use a Pearson square to achieve that 23% final concentration of alcohol so that you don't have spoilage or you don't have too much alcohol in it and it tastes too much like alcohol mm-hmm. when you're wanting to use the item.
Is that something that you can get at a pharmacy, or where do you get this measurement device?
Oh, I just look it up on the internet. It's not a device. It's just a simple calculation, and it's called a Pearson square because it looks like a square in the way that you lay out the measurements. And so, say you have like a syrup of some. A lot of times, we'll preserve or we'll extract flavors in a sugar base. Mm-hmm. So you mix maybe flowers, you mix fruit with sugar, and that pulls out a lot of the flavors, colors, phytochemicals, that sort of thing that are in that fruit or the flower, the essence of it. And then you mix that with an alcohol or something to preserve those flavors for using later. Mm-hmm. And so you'd set in the Pearson square, you set the percent alcohol that's in your alcohol source above the percent alcohol that's in your sugar extract, which is zero. And the goal, then in the middle of the square, you put the goal for what you want the alcohol percent to be, which would be 23%. 23 to 25% is a good stabilizing amount as a percentage. And then you subtract on the diagonal. So subtracting on the diagonal gives you the parts of alcohol to the parts of the non-alcohol component. Mm. And you sum those two parts. And so that gives the total. And if you divide each part by the sum, you get a percentage of the alcohol and a percentage of the non-alcohol parts that would be necessary to mix together to achieve that 23% solution and that stable for the shelf and storage amount.
Gosh, I just put a bunch of fruit in a jar and poured alcohol on it and didn't pay any attention to the level of alcohol. Oh, yep. My gosh. So how do you measure? Can you measure alcohol with some kind of tube or something? How do you do that?
You can do alcohol and alcohol content measurements, and that's often done with beer making or wine making.
Right.
And,
I think that's where we encountered it.
Yeah, there's tools for that. And what I usually am doing, I mean, I guess in the future I would love to be making more of our own alcoholic type items, but we've made beer and I've made wine in the past, but none of them are high alcohol content. And the thing that I like about the Everclear and these other distilled liquors is that they are really high in alcohol content, so it doesn't take a large volume of alcohol to preserve the items. It takes a much smaller volume. And so I don't need to measure those because the measurement is already on the bottle when it comes. I mean, if you're making your own, though, then you would be using those tools that the wineries and the brewing companies use for measurement of alcohol content.
Mm-hmm. So we're just saying that you do these usually with fruits or herbs?
Yep, fruits and herbs and pretty much anything that I like the flavor of and that I want to extract and preserve the components of. So mm-hmm. we can preserve vitamin C from lemons and limes and things like that in alcohol too, which is how scurvy was prevented on ocean going voyages, and they just preserve the limes and lemons in alcohol so that they would have the vitamin C that was necessary and it was stable. It didn't rot.
Right. Your fruit just would just go bad. You just couldn't keep. Yeah.
Right.
So you were going back. We started on a salad dressing to go on these wild greens. So go on with your recipe.
Yes. So the salad dressing, I'm often looking to my shelves of preserved things for making salad dressings.
Okay.
And typically salad dressings that are kind of a sweet and sour oil-based salad dressing is what we're often liking. So that sour component can be alcohol extracted green grapes. They have a very sour flavor that's not too different from lemon. Or you can use vinegars that can be made from any kind of fruit that you allow to ferment into a vinegar. And or you can buy regular vinegar from the store, all different types of vinegar, but some kind of sour component. And then an oil base, and we typically are using olive oil, but around here, if somebody was being resourceful, they would use the hazelnuts and the hickory nuts and the oak nuts and walnuts to extract the oil from those, and then you can use those for your oil base in salad dressings.
Or sunflower. They could get some flour.
Yeah, sunflour too. Uh-huh. Yeah, any of the nuts and seeds that are grown or just available around here can be used to extract that oil. But then we often like mustard, and we can make mustard from mustard seed that grows in the wild, mustard plants out here.
You really can. You can just get the mustard seed from those mustard plants. Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't think.
And garlic mustard, the greens of garlic mustard have a garlic flavor. If you want citrus flavor, prickly ash is one of our native understory shrubs, and it's actually a member of the citrus family that's one of the most northern members of that family. But the bark and leaves and everything of that plant are very citrusy in flavor, so an extract of that gives a very strong citrus flavor. And
I guess sorrel has a citrus flavor, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it does too. And that's good in salads too. And we don't usually use so much of the greens in dressings as we do more of the fruits and extracts for that.
Okay. Can you use sumac?
Yes. And sumac, if you soak it too long, you get too much tannin and it becomes very astringent. But initially, and then the fuzzy red coating of the sumac berries, if they've not been rained on recently, there'll be a very strong component of that. It's very sour and bright and makes great lemonade, or again, like you can preserve that and make salad dressing as long as you soak it for a short period of time and just taste it as you're soaking it to determine when you want to take the berries out of the tincture. Or you can make tea out of it with water, but you leave it in until the flavor is what you like, and then take the berries out and stabilize it, and you can mix that in. And so it's typically like the oil, the sweet component can be maple syrup, it can be honey. Those are things that we can obtain here locally. Agave, we don't easily grow agave here on my farm in Kansas. We had lots of ability to grow plants like that, but not up here. And they're more ornamental and not vigorous and reproductive up here. So sources of sweet, and then the sour balance that out, and the oil gives a good flavor. And then I like kind of the bite of something like a pepper or mustard or something that has that flavor, a little bit of salt, and mix that up and pour it on these greens that by themselves are already super flavorful and nutrient dense and that sort of thing. And it's just really satisfying as a salad, and it tastes great, and people really like it. When we use like the aronia berry extract in that, it gives that berry flavor too, and a bright pink color.
You could use other fruits for that sweetness.
Oh sure.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, definitely. Like raspberry. I mean, a lot of the I love raspberry, like black raspberries and red raspberries.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is I can eat them all way too quickly when they're fresh. But if I extract them in alcohol, then I have and add a little bit of honey or maple syrup, I have a cordial that I can use a quarter cup in a recipe for salad dressing and get that flavor and have it available to me the entire winter without having to be running the freezer for storage of that or having to can it. And a lot of the things that, like you said, get destroyed, like vitamin C in the canning process, we can preserve that in alcohol and reap the benefits of that during the winter when we're making
food. I'm beginning to get the idea. So you must have a lot of different jars of things sitting in alcohol, labeled, dated,
yes.
Right?
And often with the recipe on them even though I have a recipe book, when I want to go find something, I don't have it as organized as I would like.
Oh.
So I just grab the jar and I'm like, oh, I need more of this. I'll make some more of this. And here's the recipe right here.
Oh, good. And then you could probably just make a quart of your salad dressing and just have it, you know, you don't have to make it up every time.
Yep.
Yeah.
I just set that in the fridge. And
yeah.
It doesn't, by the time you make salad dressing, because you're adding oil and juice and things, vinegar or whatever to it, it doesn't have enough alcohol content to be shelf stable. And so then
it needs to be
in the fridge.
It needs to be refrigerated.
And it will separate because the oil will float to the top, and then you just shake it up before using it. But it stores for weeks in the fridge, and it's great. And it's also really amazing how long those fresh picked leaves from the weeds in the around the farmstead will preserve too, just in the fridge, even with salad dressing on them. Like, we don't eat all of our salad, and so we put the extra in the fridge, and it can be a couple weeks and they're still held up and not like a soggy green slimy mess in the bowl. It's amazing.
Wow. Yeah, because just the, you know, our domestic lettuce, I mean, you know,
yep.
Grown in our garden.
Very quickly.
Well, it will. Yeah, right. Oh, well, that's a real advantage right there. So what you're saying is one of the ways to preserve fresh things for the winter is to tincture them in alcohol.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you were saying that you preserve a lot of the, you know, food value.
Right.
That way, and it's not destroyed. And another way is fermentation, right?
Yeah, so we will often ferment our asparagus and green beans and carrots and oyster fern curls and beets and that sort of thing. And yeah, it's, I mean, very simple, natural fermentation organisms are just in the air. And we have books on fermentation, and we just follow recipes in there and ideas and
It's basically salt.
Yep.
Is
the salt
right
and water. And,
mm-hmm. So you have I noticed you had Sandor Katz books. Those would be a good source for fermentation ideas, right?
Yes. Yeah. The Wild Fermentation and the Art of Fermentation are both really fun books with lots of great information and unending projects when you start digging into those and really good food that results from it in the end.
Right. I just do want to put out a little caveat about gathering wild foods that you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You listed a bunch that probably people could fairly easily identify or go out with somebody who knows.
Right.
But you really don't want to go through the woods and taste things or through your fields and taste things all by yourself without any kind of guidance.
Yes, and fortunately these days, and I mean in the past, I always had my Spring Flora of Wisconsin book to key out what I was looking at or the various botany books that I have. But these days we have apps on our phones that can, you take a picture and instantly it can tell you what the plant is. And you can verify that by any of these groups, but you post the picture up there and instantly people respond back, oh, that's this.
Right.
And so it's really easy when you're out and you encounter something that you don't know what it is, that you can figure out what it is. And then also on the phone, look up whether it's toxic or whether it's a good food plant or that sort of thing. But really having an idea of what the plants are that that you want to harvest when you're going out there, or you walk around your yard and your natural areas around you, and you identify plants as you're going on your walks and make a list of the ones that are the good edible ones and a list of ones to avoid, and work on remembering the identification keys for both the good ones and the bad ones, avoid the bad ones, and harvest the good ones, and don't harvest anything that you don't know what it is for sure.
Right. I really think that's important. Well, so I just remember an exchange that was on the internet a couple of days ago. Somebody said, oh, how are, you know, are these berries okay? I tasted them. And it was like people wrote back and said, that's honeysuckle berry. You can't eat that. Don't just eat something you don't know. So,
right, yes.
Yeah.
Those taste awful. I mean,
even birds aren't eating them. But I found out that some things that birds eat are not okay for humans. So you can't even say, well, the birds eat them, so they're not toxic, you know. And I think that's something that I mean, I know so little compared to what you know already. But I realize that a plant can have toxic parts and non-toxic parts.
Yes.
And so just because maybe a honeysuckle, maybe you can eat the blossoms.
Right.
But you can't eat the berries.
Or you could eat a little bit of the berries, but not a lot, and they taste so bad that you wouldn't eat very many of them anyway.
Right.
that's one thing that as people get more interested in harvesting the things around them and making food from things that just grow naturally, you get an eye for the plants that are those good ones, and you become more curious about what are these other ones, and are they good or are they not, and you teach yourself which ones are good. And then typically most communities or some community surrounding in the nearby area will probably have people that are really passionate about this sort of thing, because this is fairly common, and they will give botanical walks educational events, and you can go on those walks with these people, and they will be pointing out and helping you identify plants that are good to forage and eat, and plants to avoid, and you can also meet then a bunch of people in your area that are interested in that same thing, exchange recipes, kind of develop a community of people that are excited about finding food in our local areas that we don't have to work really hard to produce, and just do great here.
Right. It's amazing what you can do on the internet. And do you know of some particular groups that are on Facebook or that you can join? I think there's, you know, several.
Yeah, there's lots of foraging groups, and typically the foraging groups are, some of them are national or large regional areas, but others are very localized, and it's just a matter of looking for the localized ones that really can connect you with people that and the specific plants that are in your area. And different areas of the country obviously would have different plants and good and bad plants and for eating purposes. And so those, and then all the plant identification groups are great, and it's amazing how even the worldwide plant groups with thousands of people will be able to identify the plants that you have that are very local, and often the people that respond to those are the ones that would know what the local groups are. So that's a good way, if somebody responds and says, it grows in my backyard, I'm also in the upper Midwest, then you can say, oh, hey, do you know what the other local groups are that are good for this sort of thing? And that's probably the best way to find all of those and get connected with those people.
Okay, good. I just put in foraging and you'll find that. And I really recommend it recommend going with a mentor for mushroom hunting. A lot of people are getting interested in mushroom hunting, and there are many very easily identified mushrooms that you can eat, but it's still really good to go with somebody who really knows. And you just don't want to take any risks.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
We have a silvopasture that we created by thinning a degraded woodland that we purchased, and we, instead of clearing all of the tops of the trees out after we harvested the trunks for wood, we left all those tops there, and we had a tremendous, for the last 3 years, we've had tremendous growth of oyster mushrooms, golden oysters and the wild, just common oyster mushrooms everywhere on those trees, treetops. And again, there's groups, there's people, local people around us that just love mushrooms, and they do mushroom tours around the woodlands and help people identify them. Plus the Facebook groups help identify the mushrooms that are good, and often recipes for cooking them. And then we since we had literally laundry baskets full of golden oyster mushrooms just harvested from these downed wood treetops, we just dehydrated a bunch of them in the oven. And so I have gallon jars of dehydrated golden oyster mushrooms and pheasant back and all kinds of others that we just found growing wild, and we use those in the winter with like a wild wild rice, make a wild rice soup with the mushrooms and the rice and some onions, and that's really tasty.
So how do you reconstitute mushrooms that have been dried?
We just get some hot water heated up, and put the mushrooms in there and let them sit for 10 to 15 minutes, and they rehydrate. And
mm-hmm. Then you can use them as fresh mushrooms.
Yeah, and the water that they have soaked in is so flavorful and awesome for a soup base.
Right. Are mushrooms actually nutritious?
They have a lot of fiber in them. They do have minerals. There's protein in there, so... Yeah, they do have value. Plus, there's phytochemicals in a lot of these mushrooms that are anti-inflammatory, good for autoimmune issues, such as the reishi mushrooms. They have flavors that are reminiscent of meat, so they give that kind of a flavor to soups and stews and things that you put them in. Even lasagna, we've put them in lasagna, that's a meat-free lasagna. So they're really good, and yeah, they definitely have nutrient value for us, and health-promoting properties too.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
and those can be tinctured too. And there's a lot of people who will tincture mushrooms and take some of those tinctures daily for various health conditions. So. We haven't done a lot of that. Mostly we just dehydrate them and use them in soups.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's great. Yeah, well, they don't freeze well at all. That's one thing mushrooms do not like.
Right.
Yep. But I have...
You can pickle them.
Uh-huh.
Pickled mushrooms are really good.
In vinegar or what?
Yep.
Okay.
In a typical brine for pickling. We haven't fermented... We haven't tried making pickles by fermenting of mushrooms. We've only done pickling with a vinegar brine.
Right.
And
right.
That way they maintain their shape and nice and texture is good and flavor is good.
Mm-hmm. Well, then I've also had luck with just sauteing mushrooms in butter or oil, and then they freeze okay.
Yes.
And you can
freeze them in like ice cube trays and have little dollops of oil, mushroom, herb that you can just add to all kinds of stuff very easily.
Right. How do you make a meatless lasagna? What would you be putting in there?
Yeah, so actually the mushrooms are what provide more of that meat flavor, so you don't It doesn't seem like it's completely meatless, but mm-hmm. it's everything except the meat. And often if we're going meatless, we're also not using cheese. And so there's a book called Veganomicon. It's a big green book that has all kinds of really excellent recipes on vegan foods that you can eat that are really tasty and are not so complicated to make, very simple to make. And so we rely on that during the times of the year that we aren't eating meat things.
Mm-hmm. So do you use tofu much?
Yeah, we'll use tofu. Mm-hmm. And we'll cook that down in a mushroom broth or in something that gives it the good flavors and then gets the crispy texture mm-hmm. to and we often are using the extra firm tofu, or we'll use chickpeas too as a source of protein.
Mm-hmm. Now how about these dairy free cheeses, vegetable and nut based cheeses? Do you use those
are out there, but we've
not,
and some of them are good, but for us we like actual cheese so well that it's hard to eat these fake cheeses. They just aren't the same. The texture is off and the flavors are not right. And mm-hmm. so it's just, for us, I think we're a little bit too snobbish with our cheese flavor, cheese desires. So often we just, if we aren't eating cheese, we aren't eating cheese, and we'll eat cheese later when we'll have really good cheese when we eat it later.
Right. Now, you talked about making oils from nuts. Have you tried mm-hmm. to do that? And is that, or are you just acquiring oils that other people have done that processing?
We've mostly acquired oils. The way, like, Native Americans and all the books on acquiring your own and making your own oils, the way they did it is taking the acorns, hickory nuts, things like that, and grinding them up, pounding them between rocks, and then you soak them in water. And if you apply heat, even more oil comes out. But you can boil them, and the oil will rise to the surface and out of the nuts, and leaves the meat of the nuts behind. The other thing that's nice about that is that with, like, hickory and oak, the tannins are not fat soluble. Tannins are the astringent, bitter part of the nuts that make the meat, without doing a boiling process, too astringent to really eat as a protein source. So boiling them removes the water, extracts the tannins, the oil floats to the surface and does not contain the bitter or the astringent tannins. And then the nut meat that's left behind is mostly protein and a little bit of carbohydrate, free of most of the tannins. So then you can use that for like a flour or a protein mash for mixing into other things. And so that's one way to extract oil. And another way is the expulsion process of running the nuts through a machine that compresses them typically into a pellet and squeezes the oil out. And mm-hmm. so you can get cold pressed oils that way. And those are less modified than if you heat the oil through the boiling process, mm-hmm. is what you would do if you're getting it out of like the way the Native Americans did. And but those are, we have so many around us, so many hickory trees and species beyond just the shagbark hickory, and some of those are really, really good oil trees for the hickory oil. And there's a gentleman in Minnesota, I think, who has a business. He pays people to go collect their hickory nuts so he can crush them and express the oil out of them and sell that that local hickory nut oil. That truly is like our version of olive oil. If Americans didn't have a taste for olive oil when they moved here, they would have the hickory tree would be the American version of the olive tree, and we'd be harvesting and using hickory oil instead of olive oil in most of our cooked foods and, mm-hmm. and other dressings and various other things.
Wow, that's very interesting. Now, we do have the local hazelnut company, which is really, yep. it's in Gay's Mills, the American yes. Hazelnut Company. And so they're extracting a cold-pressed hazelnut oil, which is available locally in stores, yep. in the yeah. co-ops at least.
And the hazelnuts are very abundant here in woodlands that are not heavily disturbed. They're an understory plant, natural native understory plant here in the upper Midwest, and our farm in the areas where we don't have the goats grazing, because the goats will kill those plants if not managed to prevent that. But those hazelnuts are everywhere, and if you can get to them before the deer do, then you can collect the
right.
nuts.
Yeah.
They're great for oil products, too.
Oh. Well, I just want to let you know that I'm talking with Sherry Nolden. You can see that she just is a wealth of knowledge. She lives near Dodgeville and has been studying, you know, just from experience and trial and error and reading lots of books and really... you know, working with mentors to get this tremendous knowledge of the wild foods that are available to us. And you're listening to Who's in the Kitchen. I'm Philothea Beeson, and you're tuned into WDRT Community Radio, coming from Viroqua, Wisconsin, in the Driftless area, 91.9 FM. We have a radius of about 25 miles, so if you want to hear it further away, anywhere in the world, you can go on the World Wide Web and go to our website, WDRT.org. Isn't it just amazing that people can listen to a little station here in a town of 4,000? And you can listen from all over the world. So, Sherry, I am just so much enjoying talking with you, and you have just a wealth of knowledge. I think what interests me, too, besides the wild foods for us, is you've really expanded my knowledge and curiosity about the wild foraging for your domestic animals. I never really met anybody that was really trying to improve their native pasture for their animals and really, you know, went into testing and so forth. Could you talk a little bit about that? I mean, how you
sure.
improve the food for your livestock?
Yeah, well, I mean, most pastures that are planted with horticulturally selected species of forage plants that are easily digestible, have good durability in our climate, the amount of rainfall and temperatures, the freezing winters, they can survive that and grow and don't reproduce too quickly during the summer, because typically you when the plants go into a reproductive form, they become more ligninous, and lignin is not a digestible carbohydrate, so it is essentially a fiber that slows down passage rate and reduces the amount of food that an animal can consume. So we want, typically when we're planting pastures, to be planting them with stuff that's very digestible, doesn't have a lot of reproductive parts as part of the plant, and puts weight on the animals that are being grazed for typically producing milk or meat or other food items. And we have kind of a mix of species that are like that. So we have sheep and goats that we are rotationally grazing around and browsing around our farmstead. But we also have horses that are a type of very easy keeping horse that actually do better on that reproductive type plant. So our pastures include all of the normal things that everybody plants around here that does well for all of the cattle. But we also encourage all of the native species and the weeds that want to grow in this area, because all of those plants have phytochemicals in them and polyphenols and things that are health benefiting or have some benefit for like worm control, parasite control, or anti-inflammatory or various digestive values and calming or different mineral contents, and the animals are seeking out things with different mineral contents. Grasses have lower mineral content than broadleaf plants do.
Okay.
When they're eating a lot of grass in their diet, they're getting a lower amount of mineral per gram of dry matter that they're consuming compared to eating the leaves of broadleaf plants or the leaves of trees and shrubs, which have even greater mineral content than the forbs do, than the broadleaf plants. So we, in our pastures, we don't spray out, we don't use any pesticides, we don't spray out any of those broadleaf plants that want to come in, and so we have lots and lots of species besides the typical forage plants. Plus, we have a ring of woodland around our pastures for the horses mainly, that provides all of these understory and large tree species and shrub species that the horses do eat. We rotate the goats and sheep through there to control like the multiflora rose and the other shrub species that can be kind of a pain because of sharp thorns, or they can overtake an area. The goats really enjoy honeysuckle, and they aren't at all bothered by any of the toxic components. And they can remove that from the understory while allowing us to have space for some of the more desirable plants.
And what are some of the desirable plants that you're encouraging?
Typically, we want the plants. I would prefer native species in the understory rather than some of these invasives, like the prickly ash is one of the natives, but a lot of people think of it as an invasive species because it will become quite dominant in an understory. But from a food value, it has a lot of like antihistamine and has that citrus flavor that I was talking about earlier. Animals that are eating the leaves and the bark from prickly ash, if you smell their breath, they smell like they've been eating oranges.
No.
Yeah. So, or like if a goat is ruminating after she's been eating some of that, she smells like her cud smells just like citrus fruit. So that's one of the species that we encourage, and we like the brambles, the blackberries, raspberries, the a lot of the typical understory shrubs are where we get a lot of our berries and nuts, and those species are really useful for us as food sources. Plus, the animals really like them, and like I said, with the sheep competing for our salad in the lawn, we're often competing for the berries with the horses and the other animals in the woods. Unfortunately, the goats like to eat the leaves off the brambles, but they don't actually like the berries. And why? I don't understand that, but we're perfectly happy with that because it makes harvesting the berries even easier.
Oh, wow. That's great. Well, then I'm thinking of like aspens or...
trees. All the different trees that grow here have different benefits. And I can't think of one that we've had. Well, I guess, I mean, some people will say, well, cherry trees are a dangerous thing to have around livestock because wilted cherry leaves are have a cyanide compound in them, and you can kill livestock if they eat the wilted. But if they eat fresh leaves or if they eat dehydrated leaves from cherry trees, it's not a problem. So we have cherries. We don't bother getting rid of them. We also have walnuts, and the horses eat the walnut leaves and deworm themselves with the juglones and things that are in the walnut leaves. and they don't eat too much of it, so we don't have any toxic issues.
Mm-hmm. I remember a story about the Tompton. Do you remember? Do
oh,
you
yes.
know that?
Yes.
And in the wintertime, the Tompton goes into the barn and gets, I think, aspen branches. Mm-hmm. And feeds them to the cattle. And I thought, I can't understand. How could they do that? I mean, did the farmers actually gather branches in the fall and store them in their barns and then feed dried aspen leaves to their cattle?
Yeah.
Is that possible?
So, yeah, in places where hay is hard to harvest and
yeah.
where you may have more trees than fields of hay, people harvested what today we would call tree hay.
Really?
I had hang those in the rafters of the barn, and from a volume perspective, it doesn't it's not as compressed, and it's not as much dry matter per volume as a source of hay for the animals would be, but in places where they just don't have a lot of hay ground, then the tree leaves and species like aspen are definitely species that these animals can eat and extract because they have big fermentation chambers in their bodies, unlike what we have. They can extract energy. Their microbes can extract energy out of the cellulose in those plants, and they're beneficial for feeding over winter. And if the horses have access to those, even during the summer, they'll eat them very readily. So there's
wow.
lots of species like that, that mostly that tradition we see that would be repeatable in this region of the country is what comes from Europe and how peasants maintained their livestock over winter.
Right, right. That was so I learned that from a children's book from Norway.
Yes, yes. And the Tompton stories are always Tompton and Nissa stories are always fun to read and cute and very enjoyable.
Right. Oh, I've been talking with Sherry Nolden from the Dodgeville area. She was educated at University of Wisconsin and is really in a kind of agricultural and animal husbandry that is, you know, really related to natural ecology. It's just, it's so fun to talk with you. Thank you for so much for being on Who's in the Kitchen, Jerry.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, this you've been listening to WDRT, Who's in the Kitchen. My guest has been Sherry Nolden, and you can listen to this show again on a podcast if you go to the archives. I'm Philothea Beeson, and I thank you so much, listeners, for tuning in to the show. It's always on at noon on Saturdays, and we'll see you again next week.